I lived in Montreal for many years. I've been in the United Kingdom for the past 6 years. Finished a PhD a year ago, and what I'll present is a small portion of part of my PhD research. It was a practice-led recherche et création, and in the practice, outcomes were a lot of computer-generated text, variable texts, and so this is a more historical of looking at some of very early ideas of computer-generated texts. And stop me anytime. I think the reason I wanted to do this was to put contemporary practices of digital and variable texts in a broader social context. I started to think about generation. I mean, this term computer-generated text is kind of ridiculous. It's not a good term in English, and of course it's different in French, but I wanted to think about generations in the sense of a human generation. So the idea of, you know, a group of people that are about the same age, that have the same ideas. So why does one generation choose one mode of expression or one fashion over another? It's roughly 30 years between human generations. The time span for generations of computers is much faster, and for software, it's much faster still. So I'm interested in this atemporality between human generation, computer generation, software generation. So thinking a lot about that time. A lot of critical writing about digital literature and computer generated text starts with some sentence that's approximately computer generated text is one of the oldest forms of experimentations with computers, or the history of digital writing is intertwined with the computer. So everything seems to start with the computer. I wanted to start much further back. This is a text from the 4th century. Obviously combinatorial texts existed long, long, long before the computer. The I Ching, you know, dice type things. So this is a text. The German media theorist Florian Kramer talks about this text. It's Porphyrius, Porphyrius, is a 4th century poet, and who sort of coined this classical rhetorical figure of permutato, permutation. So this is four columns of words that can be combined in any order and to create 1.62 billion possible permutations. So, you know, we always talk about the, we talk about some classic examples like the however many million poems, you know, example. So this has been going on even in classical times. And the whole book is amazing, actually. There's texts like letter squares with crosses through them and all kinds of computational things, combinatorial texts in there. What's interesting to me in this particular poem is that the indivisibility between the formal structure of the poem and what it's talking about. So according to Florian Kramer, because I can't read this, but apparently he can, the poem tells of disharmonic junctions, uneven meters, rough tones, and confused words tormenting the singer of the poem. So it's a self-reflexive text, which, even as the words are jumbled in these columns, it's performing and confusing itself simultaneously. So the text is what it does. It, you know, the formal structure parallels the content, which I think is really important. So that was the 4th century, moving ahead to the 18th century. I mean, there are a lot of other examples here, but this was an example I find really interesting in the in Gulliver's Travels. Do you all know Gulliver's Travels? Mm-hmm. So English, I think it was first published in 1726 or something, Jonathan Swift. And this section in chapter 5, Gulliver is taken on a tour of the Grand Academy of Legato, where a professor demonstrates a machine designed for improving speculative knowledge by practical and mechanical operations. So this is the island, and this is the machine, which is the image Gina put on the poster. So this is in the 18th century, an English literary text prefiguring the idea of machine language. So I'll read the description from the book. It was 20 feet square, composed of several bits of wood about the bigness of a die, linked together by slender wires. These bits of wood were covered on every square with paper, and on these papers were written all the words of the language of the people, in their several modes, tenses, and declinations, but without any order. The pupils took each of them hold of an iron handle, and giving them a sudden turn, the whole disposition of the words was entirely changed. The professor then commanded 36 of the lads to read the several lines softly as they appeared on the frame. And where they found 3 or 4 words together that might make part of a sentence, they dictated to the 4 remaining boys, who were scribes. 6 hours of the day, young students were employed in this labor, and the professor showed me several volumes in a large folio already collected of broken sentences, which he intended to piece together, and out of these rich materials, to give the world a complete body of all the arts and sciences. So this is a satirical text, and it's a criticism of things that were going on in England at the time, and the Royal Academy, and it's an absurd. He's putting forward this absurd idea that a machine could, you know, replicate all human knowledge. He says, with a machine such as this, the most ignorant person at a reasonable charge and with little bodily labor may write books in philosophy, poetry, politics, law, mathematics, and theology without the least assistance from genius or study. So why study if you have a machine to do this? So this satire belies a genuine and not entirely unfounded fear that the machine might one day replace the human. And certainly since the Industrial Revolution, at around the same time as this text, human labor has been increasingly devalued in large-scale production. Precision work, such as weaving and printing and manufacture and assembly. As a lot of things like the making of cloth and lace and fine work has been replaced by machines, the arts and especially the idea of writing was held up as something that a machine could never do. This, you know, this has been a long-held belief, so certainly since the rise of the computer. And right around the time of the rise of the computer, there was a lot of anxiety and a lot of writing in English, and I don't know in French, about the idea of computer-generated text. It was just a terrifying idea. So this is Roald Dahl is a famous English children's book author. I think he wrote. Did he write James and the Giant Peach, or was that Mordecai Richler?
No, he didn't.
Was that him?
Yeah.
So he wrote a lot of children's books, but he also wrote this book, wrote a short story called The Great Automatic Grammatizator, which was 1948. I mean, really, really, really early on. And it was a short story in which a machine writes such excellent fiction that its creator soon dominates the field of publishing. So this is a machine that takes over the publishing industry. This is Alan Turing 1950, 2 years later, the ACE pilot model. The ACE was a computer that Alan Turing worked on building. After Bletchley, he worked at Cambridge. Cambridge is the something. So it was a machine that was built at Cambridge. And it was such a bureaucratic nightmare that Turing eventually quit Cambridge and went up to Manchester, which I'll talk about in a minute. But in so this is 1950. So in 1951, Alan Turing gave a very famous talk on the BBC. So like the CBC, and he says, "Consider the naive point of view of the man on the street. He hears amazing accounts of what these machines can do. Most of them apparently involve technical feats of which he would be incapable." He says, "It might, for instance, be said that no machine could write good English, or that it could not be influenced by sex appeal or smoke a pipe. I cannot offer any such comfort, for I believe that no such bounds can be set. Attempts to produce a thinking machine seem to me to be in a different category. The whole thinking process is still rather mysterious, but I believe that the attempt to make a thinking machine will help us greatly in finding out how we think ourselves." So, you know, not the idea that the machine is going to replace us, but it's that the attempt to try to make the machine think is an attempt to try and understand how we think. And, you know, so to detone this sentence slightly, I think that the whole writing process is still rather mysterious, but I believe the attempt to make writing machines helps us understand how we write ourselves. So from this position, I mean, I make no qualitative assessments about what kind of texts these writing machines, these computer-generated texts, make. So a lot of the discourse around computer-generated texts, is it as good as human writing? This is not interesting to me. For me, the whole process is how the generative text helps me understand what I'm trying to do, how the random process helps me understand what I'm trying to do. And focusing on this attempt as the site of creative thought, not the final output, but and this is very much a pragmatic approach of a pragmatic approach to reading and writing and to trying to understand text generation in relation to a wider world, not just as a text devoid of anything else. This is a recreation of a machine that Turing built at Bletchley Park. Do you all know what Bletchley Park is? Yes?
No.
So in the United Kingdom, the Bletchley Park was the secret headquarters. It's a house. It was a stately home, a sort of a mansion in the English countryside. And it was the home of the code-breaking activities. And it's where Alan Turing, you know about Alan Turing breaking the Enigma code. This is what everybody talks about. Well, first of all, it wasn't just him. There were hundreds of people there, and he was part of a team. But secondly, it was at this location, and so whenever an American tells you that the first computers were invented in America, it's just not true. But at Bletchley Park, they were all top secret because of the war. You know, America came into the war much later on. So there's a whole series of machines that were invented in the United Kingdom under the Official Secrets Act that only came to light later. So this has been an interesting part of my research. So this is called a bomb. It was called that because of the loud ticking sound that they produce. So these little things, and they turn over and they make a huge racket. So, you know, the Enigma machine was this encoded thing. And so what this does is it just goes through all of the possibilities until it figures out what the code must be. This is not a computer. This is a calculator. It doesn't. It can only do one thing. So it goes through all of these possibilities until it finds a thing that fits. This was built, this is the Colossus, and this is arguably one of the first computers. And I'm not interested, again, in first, but I'm interested in how many firsts there are. So, and it's, and on both sides of the Atlantic. And one thing I wanted to say is, like, this was a huge amount made possible by Polish technology. The Poles invented a first generation of this machine, and then gave all the information to the British because they were no longer in a position to develop it further. I guess a big thing to say here is, you know, all computers, like all this stuff, it's all made possible by war. You know, there was huge amounts of funding made possible for the invention of these computers. All the computers that we have today starts from during World War II. They needed these huge machines to calculate ballistic trajectories and to break codes, and so money that would never have been dedicated to these projects was thrown into these projects. So this Alan Turing did not work on this machine. This was invented by a guy named Flowers, which is nice, and. It was illegal to take photographs at Bletchley Park, so this is a very rare photograph of. It was all women who worked on these machines. It was all women who fed data to the machines and took care of the machines. I don't know if you know N. Catherine Hale's book, My Mother Was a Computer. Well, it's a common expression that a computer used to be. A person, and usually a woman, who did the computation, manual computation. So I've seen these machines. They built a recreation of this machine at Bletchley Park. Bletchley Park is now a museum, and you can go look at this stuff. It's really amazing. If you ever go to England, try and go there. It's an amazing place. So this was built in 1943, and it was the world's first electronic digital fixed program single-purpose computer with variable coefficients. There's a lot of other first computers that have a lot of other criteria, but that's what this one does. So that's just like a sort of bit of early computer history. So getting into a bit of more like e-lit kind of digital writing stuff, I'm sure you all know about this book. Very influential and, in the emerging field. In prehistoric digital, poetry and archaeology of forms, Chris Funkhauser says that the oldest computer-generated poetry was created by Theo Lutz, who began experimenting with random variation texts in 1959. So, you know, in the title he says prehistoric digital poetry starts in 1959. So Lutz was a student of the very famous German writer and maths philosopher Max Benz. And it was Benz that suggested that Theo Lutz started experimenting with these computers. And in a way, Lutz was putting some of Benz's theories into practice. And this was the computer that Theo Lutz was working on in 1959. It's the Zeus Z 2-2 computer. It was built by Conrad Zuse in 1956. So, you know, while the Americans claimed they were building the first computers and the British claimed that they were building the first computers, the Germans were also building the first computers. And Zuse is a really fascinating character. He had been working completely independently before the war, and during the war he was conscripted by the Nazis to make machines for the Nazis. And hey, salut. So, you know, everybody was working for the government during the war. You know, they had to. I don't think he was particularly a Nazi. But anyway, he made a lot of computers. So this, you know, the Z22 is like number 22. It's, you know, this is also a generation of machines. So So Chris Funkhauser says that the work that Theo Lutz was making on this machine is the first ever, you know, experimentation, computer-generated text using a computer. And he situates it very much within the realm of poetry. But Theo Lutz, when he wrote about the experiments that he made using this machine, in an essay that was, because Max Benz had a journal, so he published an essay about his own experimentations, and he framed them entirely in scientific terms. So Theo Lutz says, the Z22 is especially suited to applications in extra mathematical areas. It is particularly suited to programs with a very logical structure, i.e. programs containing many logical decisions. The machine's ability to be able to print the results immediately on demand on a teleprinter is ideal for scientific problems. So there's a real contrast here between how Christopher Funkhauser is claiming this for poetry, but Theo Lutz is talking about it in really mathematical terms. And the most famous, well-known, and in part well-known because of Christopher Funkhauser's book, text that Theo Lutz made was based on The Castle, which sort of basks in a ongoing fascination with this work by Franz Kafka. So The Castle is a very well-known work by Kafka. It was unpublished at the time of Kafka's death, and Kafka asked his best friend Max Brod to destroy all of his work, and Brod didn't, and heavily edited this work. So we think of this work as being by Kafka, but it's actually a very heavily edited work by somebody else. And the formal structure of this work sort of lends itself very well to being adapted for a computer-generated text, because it's already very fragmented. And the story itself has a sort of, there's an unattainable goal of an ending in this story, so it kind of works for an endless text. You know, so I think my question is what if Lutz had chosen a different text? I think Funkhauser thinks that this text is literary because it refers to the castle. What if he had chose a different text to work with, you know, because he was thinking of it very much as a scientific text. Obviously, Funkhauser, you know, prehistoric digital poetry, he's only thinking about poetry. And so I think it's pretty ironic that he's saying, Funkhauser says, the pursuit of composing poetry by using computer operations began in 1959 with a text composed with a very logical structure from a database comprised of a selection of subjects and titles from a well-known print novel. So I think Funkhauser's focus is why he thinks that this is literary is a lot to do with that the source text is a literary text, but the source text is actually a novel, and he's categorized this as a poem. Funkhauser, another sort of critique that I have of Funkhauser is that all of his analysis is based on output text. He doesn't really deal with the process. You know, whereas Florian Kramer says that written combinatory literature does not denote the generated text itself, but only a formal set of instructions. So, you know, the attempt is the text, not the output text. So, and also in prehistoric digital poetry, Funkhauser focuses his analysis on an output of Theo Lutz's The Castle that's an English translation of a German text. So it's quite far removed from what the text is itself. Funkhauser makes no mention whatsoever of, so this is Kafka and Max Brod, who published The Castle, and this is one output of The Castle, but, you know, it goes on and on. And I won't show it, but Nick Mompert's made a JavaScript version of The Castle that's available online. If you ask me after, I can show it to you. So I want to move on now to a different computer-generated text that was actually made in 1952 that Christopher Funkhauser makes no mention of, which is the Love Letter Generator by Christopher Strachey. Do you guys know about that? Mm-hmm. Yeah. 1952 in Manchester, and I wrote to Chris Funkhauser, and I asked him why he didn't, you know, why he didn't talk about the Love Letter Generator, why he said, you know, I'm going to start with Lutz in 1959. And he replied, I quote, "I was aware of Strachey's work, but did not consider it to be in the realm of poetry, at least as I was willing to define it, which was pretty wide." Now, you know, I like Chris, I know him really well, but this just seems nuts to me to make a decision between what's poetry and what's not poetry. You know, I think it's a bit of a disservice to the field because I go to lots of conferences and talks where people are talking about Lutz as being the first ever, you know, experiment in combinatorial text using mainframe computers, and it's just sort of, anyway, so I'm going to talk about this. So that's one of the reasons why I wanted to look at Strachey's Love Letter Generator. And another reason I had was I had a big argument with somebody else about, you know, whether or not it was literary. Okay, so is it poetry or not? And even if is it literary or not? This is also a sort of crazy and useless question to me. So I spent a lot of work in my PhD thesis trying to situate this within a broader realm of the literary. What, you know, and I'm Catherine Hales's broader distinction of the literary in her book on electronic literature. I'm sort of thinking about this broader idea. So taking into account the social context of the production and publication and public presentation of the work, and considering the process rather than simply the output. So this picture is the Manchester University computer Mark I, and this is Christopher Strachey, Alan Turing, and some other guy, who I totally forget who it is, but it's written somewhere. Alan Turing and Christopher Strachey are almost of the same generation, but not quite. Christopher Strachey was a little bit younger. They're both brilliant. Strachey also worked on code breaking during the war, kind of puzzlers, maths, games. They were both gay. They were both, it was an extremely precarious time to be a gay man in the United Kingdom. I mean, it's ultimately what did Alan Turing in. Christopher Strachey was a little better socialized, I would say, and dealt with it. But they were both sort of dealing with this post-war entrenchment of homophobic values in the United Kingdom. So Alan Turing wrote the manual for this computer in Manchester. And Christopher Strachey was working on that other computer I showed you earlier at the ACE computer at Cambridge. They both went to Cambridge. They were both in maths at King's College, Cambridge. And Christopher Strachey decided he wanted to build a checkers game on the ACE computer, and it didn't have enough memory, so he found out that Alan Turing was working on this computer and it had more memory, so he wrote to Alan Turing and asked for a copy of the manual, and Alan Turing gave him a copy. Never having seen the computer, Christopher Strachey wrote, unbeknownst to himself, the longest program that had ever been written for this machine, and went up to Manchester in the summer when nobody was using it, and only had to change about three lines, and it ran like that. And Alan Turing said, okay, you've got to work here, and basically hired him on the spot. And Noah Wardrop Frun, this is in this book, approaches, applications, and implications to media archaeology. There's a really good chapter in this book by Noah Wardrop Frum who looks at Christopher Strachey's Love Letter Generator in terms of process. So instead of focusing on the output, looks entirely at the process of the thing. Attributes to Strachey the first experiment with digital literature and digital art of any kind. So the texts between these are a bit dark. These are photos from the Christopher Strachey All Christopher Strait Cheese papers are held at the Bodleian Library at Oxford. So some of these next slides are my own slides of, are my own photos from the paper. So the texts that are produced by this, you know, they're not poetry, they're not prose, they're letters. This is a long tradition, you know, the epistolatory form is a long tradition. They sound like nonsense. You are my avid fellow feeling. My affection curiously clings to your passionate wish. My liking yearns for your heart, my tender liking. You are my, so they're sentences, but they're nonsense sentences. They could sound amateurish, or they could sound really outlandish. You know, it's confusing, which is why I think literary scholars stayed away from them for a long time. So the way it's built is with lists. So noun, verb, adjective, adverb, and can't remember what that is. So, you know, my darling love, you are my avid fellow feeling. My affection curiously clings to your passionate wish. These are all words chosen from the thesaurus. He made deliberately no attempt to be creative. He just went to the thesaurus and found all of the, you know, which to me is a very modern approach. It's very flarf. It's very, you know, conceptual writing. And this is in 1952. The signature for all of the letters is from MUC, which is the Manchester University computer, and it sounds like a deliberate interrogation of the notion of authorship to me. And Alan Turing and Christopher Strait Cheese, these two gay guys, you know, sitting around this very expensive computer, outputting these absurd love letters, and posting them on bulletin boards around the university, and this is documented, people know about this, and then Alan Turing's biographer, there's a very good biography of Alan Turing in English by Andrew Hodges, so just to say, I think that for me, that's one of the big reasons why this is literary. I mean, this is considering an engagement with audience. You know, it's publicly posting. It's a form of publishing. They're not just doing it themselves. You know, they're gauging reaction. And Turing's biographer suggests that the response was not very positive. Those doing real men's jobs on the computer, concerned with optics or aerodynamics, thought this silly. But it was as good as a good way as any of investigating the nature of syntax, and it greatly amused Alan and Christopher Strachey, whose love lives, as it happened, were rather similar. So the whole purpose of the love letter generator was to test the random number function on the Manchester University Mark I. So it was a very scientific thing, but they chose to do it through language, and they found it amusing. You know, I wonder if scholars like Funkhauser and others have dismissed the love letter generator as just being silly, like the real men doing real men's jobs. Wardrop Frun cautions that the resulting letters are not really the interesting part of the project. Just wanted to show you, this is what the source code looks like. It's a nightmare. There's pages and pages and pages of this. I mean, it was not an easy thing to do. It's not a frivolous undertaking to program this machine. You have to be really determined. Who knows? I have no idea. But look, adjective, noun, adverb, you see on the left. So there's, you know, he's working through a really complex problem. So whether the output looks silly or not, this is a pretty invested project. Previous to the love letter generation, as I say, he created this checkers program. That was a much more sophisticated program. It was an extremely complicated and, you know, like I say, the longest bit of code ever written for this machine. And so he could have programmed the love letter generator to be much more sophisticated, but he chose not to. I mean, he was doing a very specific thing. He created a system of deliberate simplicity, a process designed to fail, and designed to fail humorously. I mean, it was designed to create these letters that fail to express love, and quite funny. So a lot of people, Roberto Simonowski included, have said that people who are only looking at the very few outputs of the thing that made it into public have, said, oh, well, Christopher Strachey was gay and he was parodying heterosexual love. And in the few outputs that were output, there was no mention of the word love, and people made these wild associations, oh, the love that dare not speak its name, which is nonsense, because love is in the full list of the words. And Mordred Freund, because he's looking at process rather than output, he's really stressing that actually, this isn't a parody of heterosexual love, or it's a parody of the process of writing. Just looking up words in the thesaurus, without actually thinking yourself what it really feels, using a machine to just do it for you. So I think it's a really interesting distinction, and I really recommend that article. I would also say that Wardrop Fun points this out, and my own research bore it out, that Strachey had plans for a much more sophisticated love letter generator, which that man replaced by him after first use mother only once in a letter. I mean, he was starting to build a pretty complex with a lot of if-then statements, forking paths kind of letter, and it's hard to see in here, but when you look at all of the papers, it was a really interesting project, and he abandoned it shortly after Alan Turing's death in 1954, because what's funny after that? So it's interesting to me that when we're as I said in the beginning, this relation between generation, so imagine the social generation they're in, and that's causing Alan Turing to commit himself, commit suicide, kill himself. And, Christopher Strachey sort of abandoned this playful and experimental digital writing sort of approach and went into hardcore programming. He actually came to Canada shortly after this and did a whole bunch of work, both in Toronto and doing mathematical mathematical models for St. Lawrence Seaway water flow something. I mean, he went on to be a really interesting computer scientist. And so what if he had gone on and continued to make these works? In his own writing about at around the time of Turing's death, he wrote a classic paper called The Thinking Machine. Christopher Strachey did, and he describes the love letter generator as a simple type of intelligence test. The scheme on which it works is almost childishly simple. And so he starts to kind of, downplay the work. But for me, that doesn't remove it from the realm of the literary. You start to see some of the... it is beastly without you in my arms. It is wretched without your delicious tip-tilted nose. I mean, this is going to be a much more complicated program. Interestingly, Alan Turing's or Christopher Strachey's Love Letter Generator, 1952, was prefigured. The American novelist Kurt Vonnegut, do you know him? Really famous, well-known novelist. 2 years previously, in 1950, he published a short story featuring a fictional computer called Epiac, which wrote poetry. And it was based on the ENIAC computer, which the Americans claim is the was the first computer, but it wasn't because, you know, that was invented in England. So it was unveiled in 1946 at the University of Pennsylvania and was already out of date by the time it was finished. And Kurt Vonnegut's story reappeared 2 years later in the book Player Piano, which came out in 1952, which was the year that the love... So, you know, it's entirely within the realm of possibility that Strachey chose the love letter as a form to test the random function, random number generating function of the Manchester University based on, you know, the idea, an idea that came out of a short story. I have no way to prove this, but, you know, I just want to kind of suggest that I think that it is within the realm of the literary, and I think that it's been ignored for oddball reasons and slightly spurious reasons. Christopher Strachey's love letter generator was created on the Manchester University computer, which was then built, which became the model for the Ferenti computer, which was one of the first commercially sold computers in England. And so there's a German guy named David Link who, there's been a huge amount of interest in Strachey's love letter generator by not literary theory people. So there's this German guy, David Link, who's based in Cologne, I think, and he recreated the Ferenti computer and made a version of the love letter generator. This is an exhibition that was at the Arnold Feeney Gallery in Bristol. In the United Kingdom in 2010, I think it was the old media. So these are the cathode ray tubes that were displayed the output of the text, and it was a really amazing installation. But, you know, it was completely in a new media art context and not at all in a writing context. So these ray tubes, see that thing in there? You don't see it very well, but there's one in there. So this is a recreation of the Manchester Baby, which was before the Manchester Mark One. This was like a prototype machine, and they recreated this is a recreation at the Manchester Museum of Science and Industry. And you can imagine these recreationist guys, like that they recreated Flowers Colossus machine, and, you know, it's a big thing kind of recreating these machines that were early machines. And they're just complete geeks up there. And, so I went to the Manchester Museum, and they're just like dying to talk about this machine. And they had never heard of the love letter generator, which was two generations after this machine, but very closely related. There is a guy, so the Manchester Museum of Science and Industry, which, you know, it gets a lot of government funding, they have a lot of programs for kids and stuff. They commissioned a programmer from Cornwall to create an iPad app based on the love letter generator, which is ridiculous. Like, it doesn't do any of the things that the love letter generator does. You basically just keep pushing on stuff until stuff happens. Like, it doesn't follow any of the logic that the program does. The programmer that programmed it put all of the Strachey variables online and created a PHP version of Strachey's love letter online, and he put all of the variables, and I went through them and found a lot of discrepancies between his variables and the ones that were in the in Christopher Strachey's papers at the Bodleian. And so he and I had some communications about this. And during my PHP, I remixed it. So these are all variables based on sort of keywords from my PhD thesis. So using the same structure as the love letter generator, writing and erasing lines of flight, My conceptual chapter outline scholarly explains your assemblage. My citation performatively haunts your conclusion. My mechanic subject keenly generates your mediation. You are my dialogic chapter, my interdisciplinary work. Yours creatively, JRC. So, you know, that the idea of remixing, you know, if it's remixable, then it is within the realm of the literary, as far as I'm concerned. And I also think that this, you know, this formulaic structure where I kept everything the same and I just replaced the words, in a way, you know, is exactly what Strachey was doing with the remixing, you know, just using words from the thesaurus. And I think it's very, again, you know, has a lot of resonance with contemporary practices like conceptual writing and FLARF. And I guess, you know, also I want to sort of put these in, put it just in a contemporary context. This is a 2008, I think, generator by Nick Mompfort. And again, extremely simple bit of code. But if you look at this middle line here, the gender is a variable. So in the first sentence, we have these, like, police officer near, okay, so, yeah, so we have these quite gender assumption, like a police officer, but then in the second line, it might be a he or it might be a her. So you know, a kind of very simple text that's doing a quite sophisticated social thing. So that, you know, it's not about the code here. The source code from this generator, and especially this he, her, his, her, or he, she variable, is what became, I remixed the source code to create this much longer and more complicated generator. I would say it's sort of more complicated, but it's not, because the source code remains quite simple, which is called, I don't know why this is cutting off, but which is called a transmission, a dialogue. And as many of you may know, Ariane Savoie, crazy lunatic, translated transmission, a dialogue into French, and which is on the Bleu Orange. And there is also on NT2 a article that I wrote about the process of translation, and an article here that Ariane wrote about the process of translation. So all that historical stuff is sort of what led into these were the practice-led research outcomes that I created. So I kind of want to stop there and have more of a discussion, but you know, just to say that these I think some of the ways that we've looked at some of these early texts can be quite radically resituated, you know, outside of these quite ancient ideas of whether it's poetry or not poetry, or whether it's, you know, literary or not literary, and put into a much broader social context. So
well, thank you, GR.